Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
From the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm David Reed. There are very few similarities between the mass street protests in Egypt and those in Brazil. But here's one. Many of the biggest media outlets took sides in the disputes. Our program today examines the way newspapers, broadcast outlets, and social media covered the Egyptian and Brazilian social upheavals. First, Egypt, where the media seems to be as polarized as the population. Independent publisher Hisham Kassem joins us from Cairo. And Taufik Hamid is on the line from Washington, where he is a senior fellow at the Potomac Institute for Policy Studies. Welcome to Global Journalist.
It's a pleasure to be on your show.
Thank you. Before the Arab Spring Revolution, Hisham Kassem was the publisher of Egypt's only independent daily newspaper, and he was an advocate, and is still, for democracy. He left to launch a multimedia news operation called The New Republic. Hisham, the military-run government shut down three Islamist-run television stations and raided the offices of Al Jazeera's Egyptian news channel. Egypt's first democratically elected president, Mohamed Morsi, has been detained, along with many of the top Muslim Brotherhood officials. How has the state media covered these latest developments?
State media always clever than power.
Yeah.
I mean, they basically hired guns. They were defending Mubarak to the last minute. The following day, after he fell, they basically did against him. The same is what happened with Mohamed Morsi. Mm-hmm. The 8th government-owned publishing houses of the Egypt Radio and Television Union basically were defending him to the last minute, and the next day they turned against him. And I think they will continue along these lines, whatever happened.
Mm-hmm. And Taufik, one week after the army-led coup, is the dictatorship solidly back in Egypt?
No, I don't see it as a typical coup at all, because in coup, you will typically see the military taking the first step, not the second one. Here, you see the people going into the streets, and then the military coming in. So I don't see it as a coup, and in fact, they deliver power immediately to civilians immediately. So I see this is a correction of the part of democracy. The military will still have a role maybe in politics, and it seems to be important at this stage because the military can play a role of a stabilizing force for the country.
Hisham, what about the private media? How have they been covering these latest developments and when the in the latter days of the Morsi presidency?
We need to draw a clear line here between media that uses derogatory language, that uses inflammatory language, media that incites. Incitement is something I am fully for criminalizing. When I say incitement, I'm talking about the case of Rwanda, Togo, mm-hmm. Sri Lanka, where in the International Criminal Tribunal, people were sentenced to 30 and 35 years because they were basically inciting for the committing of genocide. There are serious charges against these stations. However, we expect a transparent investigation into the matter and charges be made public to determine whether incitement has been carried out or whether this was simply derogatory language. Derogatory language, I'm totally against the shutdown, and I would be protesting it.
Taufik, do you agree that these Islamist stations deserve to be shut down?
Yeah, I fully agree with that. In fact, when you think deeply about the issue, you will see that the U.S., for example, had to kill Al-Awlaki in Yemen, the American citizen who was preaching and inciting hatred and terrorism and issued fatwa to kill his opponent, and ultimately he was killed by the military, by the U.S. military in Yemen. So I see the situation here. If you have a media that promotes different views, that's fine, and you have to keep this media and respect it. But when you have a radical Islamic media preaching hatred and inciting violence against innocent people, and you see this violence materializing into real time, you have no other option but to stop such media by law and close them. So I think that I fully support the decision of closing this radical Islamic media. But I will be against suppressing or prohibiting any media for merely objecting to your views or having different opinions from you. That's a very different situation.
And on social media, are the extreme Islamists able to get their messages out through the social media outlets still?
The towns who are supporting Morsi are declining in a very fast rate, and the sound of those who are opposing him is the mainstream now on social media. The dominance is for the anti-Morsi group. So this is how I see it happening, and maybe at some stage there was some balance of powers, but now there is complete domination on social media. People circulate things when they are against Morsi, but they don't really circulate things that are opposing, supportive of him.
Okay, and what about the domestic media? I know that Egypt has a fairly diverse range of media. I know we've been talking about the Islamist television stations and social media, but what about the other newspapers? How have they been performing?
The newspapers, depending if it's the state-owned newspapers, they just try to support whoever is in power. That is their general trend. So we can't judge with them. But for most of the mainstream newspapers, they are against Morsi, clearly. The religious newspapers that exist are for Morsi, but they are not that dominant in the society. So if you went in Cairo, for example, to buy the mainstream newspapers from any on the shelves, nearly 95% and more will be against Morsi. So the whole trend from the media is against him. You still have Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya. There were some troubles with Al Jazeera because Al Jazeera was always trying to magnify the pro-Morsi demonstrators and show that they are leading number. But in reality, the pro-Morsi group was only a few thousand, limited to small place, compared to tens of millions against Morsi. So Al Jazeera and even Al Arabiya, to some extent, are a bit is a bit biased in the situation, trying to be pro-Morsi. But Al Jazeera is explicitly pro-Morsi.
And is that continuing? Are they even now?
I think yes. It is continuing until like yesterday. I'm following what's happening. You can see it is their philosophy and their ideology, so they are not going to change it on over day and night.
Okay. And where do you see the dynamics going now as far as the state media, if they do actually move toward democracy and the military eases up on media restrictions, do you see the state media becoming more objective? What's your long view on this?
The state media will probably try to go against Morsi, and they already they started this process. It's not very strong yet as the other forms of media, but the state media certainly is moving among with the others in the same direction now against Morsi.
Hisham, could you talk a little bit about
yes.
the role of social media in what's been happening in these in Egypt with the protests?
Look, special remarks and observations on the role of social media, and I think it's going to take years before we can assess the real part that it has played. Again, like questions. Okay, a lot of the rallying happened for the anti-Mubarak of our revolution happened on social media, on Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
It remains, had Mubarak not cut the internet off and criticizing him on his book, would they have taken to the street? No. It's a very difficult question to answer. Mm-hmm. Another, the referendum that happened right after the ousting of Mubarak. It was pushing for the, or campaigning for the no votes. And yet it was a landslide, yes.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll put the question, how effective was social media in bringing about the end of the Mubarak regime? Again, okay, on the flip side, it's giving a voice for all. There's much more suppression, but it's also, on the other hand, created a lot of distortion. The amount of people who called me up to verify some information they came across on current events. And I say, where did you come across this? And it's always Facebook or Twitter or one of the social media platforms. And it's completely the information. And a lot of the websites are finding a way to spread are using social media. See? I still think it's going to take years before we can assess the role that is playing in the political developments in this part of the world.
Okay. Tawfiq, would you agree on his assessment that it's still too early to describe the impact of social media in Egypt?
I agree, but I see that the social media has been tested, and maybe the full assessment will take time, but you can certainly get the flavor of what the role of the social media in moving the people. There is no doubt that they play the role. Maybe it will take more time to quantify this role and understand it more clearly, but there is no doubt that it has played a significant role.
Okay, and finally, Hisham, what are your what are you predicting for the future of the free media in Egypt? Are you optimistic or pessimistic?
Recently, somebody asked me to speak to a group of visiting journalists about the biggest danger threatening media in Egypt, and I said there is none.
Okay, and Tawfiq, what's your perspective on that? Do you have an optimistic view of the future of the free media in Egypt?
I'm cautiously optimistic here. I have some consideration for some level of optimism because the country, I see it now in a correct direction. During Morsi time, I saw it as if it's going to become another Somalia or Afghanistan. So its direction has been corrected.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe we will not have the full freedom that many people will be dreaming of. But it will be in the correct direction, I believe so.
Okay. Well, thank you, gentlemen, for your illuminating insider's perspective on the Egyptian crisis. Hisham Qassem is the publisher of The New Republic in Cairo, and Tawfiq Hamid is a scholar at the Potomac Institute. Before we turn our focus to Brazil, I want to remind everyone that you can view or listen to this program anytime by downloading our podcasts at globaljournalist.org. You can also find interesting articles, photos, and interviews related to our program on our website. Please send us questions or comments via globaljournalist@kbia.org. Or you can go to our Facebook page. You can also follow us on Twitter at GlobalJorn. Pedro Doria is executive editor at O Globo, one of Brazil's most prominent print publications. Paulo Sotero directs the Brazil Institute at the Woodrow Wilson International Center. Welcome to Global Journalist. Now, Paulo, you're a former correspondent and were in Brazil at the beginning of the protests. Looking at the Brazilian media from a wider perspective, what are your general impressions of the coverage?
Well, initially, the traditional media was as perplexed as everybody else, as the politicians and everybody else. And many commentators admitted that. But the traditional media quickly caught up with the rallies and the protests, which were organized via social media. What is interesting, as the protests evolved, and we know now that most messages carried or exchanged between protesters were basically content produced by traditional journalists. So the information that was exchanged was coming from the traditional media. If there is one point of criticism and difficult subject of debate in Brazil when I was there, was the television coverage, because at some point the television channels were covering this as if it was just a normal thing in a democracy, which it is, but there was some criticism to the fact that in the initial act of vandalism that happened in São Paulo and then in Rio and Belo Horizonte, television stayed in a very passive, descriptive position when they probably should have, you know, made some commentary regarding the fact that, yes, we are in a democracy, you are free to protest, but public order has to be maintained.
Pedro, how would you assess overall the media coverage of these protests?
Well, no, I totally agree with Paulo. We were totally caught by surprise. Nobody was expecting anything like that. I mean, people tend to go to the streets for one of two reasons. Either you have some sort of governmental oppression or you have unemployment. And none of those are, you know, good descriptions of Brazil. We have full employment and we have a full-fledged democracy. But apparently, that's not sufficient. People want politics to work better. We are still a very corrupt country. At least that's certainly the perception of people. Of course, initially, we were trying to figure out what was happening. Apparently, there was a lot of vandalism. There weren't many people on the streets. And suddenly, the police overreacted. And, I mean, in less than a week, we went from a couple of hundred people on the streets of São Paulo to over 2 million people in the streets of Brazil in one single day. So it became huge, huge. And most certainly, the way we were covering it, the way we were understanding what was happening, changed over time. One of the most impressive, post-protest signals of what actually people were thinking is the huge drop in popularity with, you know, for pretty much all governors, pretty much all mayors. I mean, President Dilma Rousseff fell more than 25 points, I mean, 25% over in a single month. She went from over 50 to nearly 30% popularity, which is quite amazing. And I mean, politicians from every single party, from both of the opposition and the situation, were penalized by the people. And I mean, it's really interesting times. We are still trying to figure this out.
And how would you respond to accusations that O Globo and some other media outlets underreported the protests and didn't depict it at the magnitude that it was really happening?
At first, there wasn't really a magnitude. We were really talking about, I don't know, at maximum 300 people on the streets. And São Paulo is a city of, you know, 10 million people. So we're not talking about something that is very representative. But afterwards, I think we spent over a week with protests, not only in the main headlines, but pretty much dominating our front page. And that's true for us. That's true for Folha de São Paulo and Estado de São Paulo, which are the other two quality newspapers. But of course, I mean, in such a diluted protest, people have so many, you know, biases. People are complaining about so many different things that sometimes when they read on the newspaper what we are writing, sometimes they don't really relate mm-hmm. what we are describing and think that we perhaps are not saying what we should say. Okay. We are only trying to describe what we see.
Okay. Let's bring us to, up to date on what's happening in Brazil today, Pedro. Tell us about this general demonstration.
Well, we have a general strike today. There is actually an inside fight between two of the major unions. One of them is pro-government and is trying to make of this strike today something in favor of the government. The other one is, you know, trying to go for something against the government. It's really a political thing. We have roads blocked in three states of the country, three mm-hmm. of the most important states. That's São Paulo and Rio de Janeiro, naturally, also Pernambuco, which has a very important port. But we haven't been seeing signs as yet. We are still in the middle of the morning. We haven't seen signs as yet that this general strike is really stopping the country, unless we are talking about roads.
And how safe has it been to cover these protests? I know one of your reporters has been injured, and some other journalists have also been injured.
In some points here in Rio and also in São Paulo, it seemed at a point that the police was actually, you know, going for journalists. There is a photographer with Folha who may lose one of his eyes because of a shot by a rubber bullet. Many reporters were shot, and those things, you know, they can cause bad wounds. But I mean, it's also part of the job.
Okay. And Paulo, we started to get into the aspect of social media. Have they been key to getting people out in the streets?
Yes. No, they were fundamental. I think this would not have happened any other way. As Pedro was mentioning, this series of protests caught everybody by surprise. I think they are still being analyzed and processed. I think they point to something very positive in Brazil. Mm-hmm. Brazil, since we became a democracy in 1985, Brazil has made much progress in terms of rights, in terms of economic inclusion for about 40 million people that were included in the middle class or the lower middle class, if you will. People tasted prosperity with a degree of equity. You know, people started having access to consumer goods and being reminded that they have rights, and they believed it. And at the same time, the government of Brazil has given them a storyline that, you know, this country is making progress. This country is now the sixth or seventh largest economy in the world. And people compare that type of statement with their daily lives, which involves commuting 2 to 3 hours each way from home to work and back from work to home, and other grievances and cases of corruption, etc. So when this thing exploded, it was a manifestation, I believe, you could see this in the signs of a country that is people are frustrated because the pace of change is not fast enough, because the political class is not responding to people's demands. So it became a major issue that there was this disconnect, and there still is this disconnect between the people elected and the population. And right. the against the government or the federal government or state government was about a system of democracy that needs to work better. It's not against democracy.
Okay.
It's exactly the opposite.
And Pedro, finally, in our last minute, from afar, people look at these protests and they generally have a negative response to it. But do you agree with Paulo's assessment that these demonstrations actually point to a positive future for democracy in Brazil?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Paulo's description is very precise in the sense that Brazil has been a middle-class country for over 15 years now, meaning about 60% of the population is in the middle classes, and some numbers give it even more. And the thing is, in the first moment in which you find yourself in the middle class, the first thing you start doing is you buy yourself a refrigerator, you buy yourself a nice flat-screen TV. Mm-hmm. But suddenly, once you start getting used to having enough money to eat and to pay rent and etc., you start looking around and you see, well, I've been poor most of my life. My parents were poor. How do I make it safe for my children to not only be in the middle class, but perhaps to have a better chance? And suddenly you start seeing that, well, public education still is very bad. Public hospitals are still terrible, and you still don't really have access to those sorts of things.
Okay.
So what do you want? You want government to function.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for joining us on the show. Pedro Doria is executive editor at O Globo, and Paulo Sotero heads the Brazilian Institute at the Woodrow Wilson International Center.
Thank you, David.
Thank you.
We've come to the end of this week's edition of Global Journalist, produced by the Reynolds Journalism Institute and the Missouri School of Journalism. Global Journalist is directed by Travis McMillan, audio by Pat Akers. Raymond Tungekar is our executive producer. Sasu Siegelbaum and Elisa Lopez Aguado were our lead producers. Elisa is up next with Free Press Watch. And join us again next week for another Global Journalist. I'm David Reed.
And now, Free Press Watch, a weekly segment on Global Journalist, where we bring you a rundown of major events affecting press freedom around the world. I am Elisa Lopez. Today's news comes from the Committee to Protect Journalists, Free Media, The Guardian, and The New York Times. Malaysian authorities have denied a British journalist and activist entry to the country. Claire Newcastle Brown was flying there to meet lawyers over a civil suit filed against her. Once she landed, she was put on a flight to Singapore. Brown, who is the sister-in-law of the former British Prime Minister Gordon Brown, is on a travel blacklist for no publicly recognized reason. She is the founder of two news outlets in the southeastern region of Sarawak that are publicly against the Malaysian government and also leads a campaign against deforestation and state corruption. In Somalia, a TV reporter known as Karan was murdered on his way back home. Three gunmen shot Karan 6 times in the chest and then fled. He is the 5th journalist killed this year in one of the most dangerous countries for journalists. Mexican journalist Mario Ricardo Chavez was found dead in the northeastern state of Tamaulipas after 2 weeks being missing. A group of armed men apprehended him weeks ago when leaving a movie theater with his family. The corpse of the founder of the news website El Ciudadano was discovered next to the body of an unidentified female. Chavez is the 2nd journalist murdered in Mexico this year. For more information on these and other events affecting press freedom around the world, please visit our website at globaljournalist.org. Thank you for joining us this week on Global Journalist. I'm Elisa Lopez.